does it make sense for people who are 80% drug addicted and mentally ill? The co-occurring disorder is very high on Skid Row, highest of any place in the county. You know, does it make sense to kind of recycle people in and out of jail, which is the de facto unintended consequence of a public safety initiative when you don't have yet up to scale the housing and services that we need? So the answer is a new vision for Skid Row, and it's a new homelessness policy. And I want to actually just note that Helmi Hisarek, who's Deputy Mayor for Housing and Economic Development for Mayor Villaraigosa, is here. She is championing a whole new approach. We are working with the county much closer than before. And Jennifer Lassar, who's sitting next to her, has been retained to develop a 10-year Skid Row vision and action plan on housing and land use by the city. Here's our assumption. The debate has been far too polarized for far too long. When you live in the shadows, when you have a counterculture that's a lawless, a culture of lawlessness, I'll even adopt the language, it becomes incredibly polarized. And it becomes much easier to sort of perseverate on the pain, the suffering, you know, and not focus on the solutions. Well, this mayor is insisting on focusing on solutions, and one of the things that we're going to do is build a new vision for Skid Row. There will be advocates on the left edge that don't like the vision of the area. There will be people on the more conservative side, or some of the developers may not like the vision that the mayor has of a mixed income community that honors its history, as Gretchen said, that understands that they're that, you know, it's not gonna, you're not gonna sweep all the homeless people out of this area. Better we should house and service the people who are living in the area on the streets, who are still left on the streets. Moreover, we need the regional fair share solution. We need scattered site housing. We need permanent supportive housing in every council district and every quarter of the county. And my hope is that from a going forward basis from this day on out, that we would find the shared vision that I think is in this room and is increasingly shared by people, as the polls indicate, where people need to take responsibility for helping folks, for building the public will and the public support for siting the kind of permanent supportive housing that's necessary to change people's lives. It's much cheaper, and it's much more cost-effective, and it's about ending homelessness and not kind of recycling and managing homelessness. But I want to just give props to the LAPD, the city attorney's office, the mayor's office, all the city services. You know, it is really hard to move bureaucracies. I want to tell you one last little story, and then I'll stop and we'll open it up. There are a lot of littering tickets being given because Andy Smith, God bless him, one of his passions is littering, and I think it's great. However, there weren't any trash cans on Skid Row. So one of the early things that the community outreach section of Safer City Initiative was to identify this problem. I want to tell you that because we are awash in red ink in the city of Los Angeles, we can't do it. Mayor Villaraigosa can't do what Mayor Bloomberg did. When Mayor Bloomberg was elected, he had a $5 billion deficit, so he raised income taxes and he raised property taxes. Well, my boss would love to be able to do that, but we can't do that in California. So we do not have the kind of public funds that are necessary. And it took 1 year, 12 months, 1 year to get 11 trash cans onto Skid Row. Not because we didn't have the capital dollars, because we've passed bond measures that allow capital dollars for some of these city services, but because it's in the operating budget and there isn't enough money to increase the support for the street pickup for these 11 trash cans. So we finally got them out there about a month ago, and we're very pleased about it. But we're dealing with overwhelmed systems, huge numbers of people that need to be helped, and yet a kind of a new spirit that I think is going to craft out some new land use policy, some new consensus, or if not consensus, majoritarian view of a vision of Skid Row that honors its past and carves a new way toward the future. So thanks a lot, and I hope we'll all be part of the solution.
Thank you. I would ask the panelists if they have any agreements or disagreements with each other that they would like to highlight before we open it up to the audience.
I'll just say, I agree that there are many pathways to Skid Row. There are many reasons why people get to Skid Row. I think, in my view, the reason people stay on Skid Row, those that you see out on the street, is addiction. Addiction that leads to mental illness, leaving people sometimes either unwilling or incapable of knowing that they need help. Police are doing the first line triage to try to address that situation. And the other thing that was mentioned, I think, at the earlier panel, maybe it was Dr. Kaling, about the use of the word homeless. A lot of the people that are on Skid Row even today, I would not define as homeless in the traditional sense. We have people that are here on Skid Row pitching their tent, but they have homes. They live in flophouse hotels. Some live in actually very nice communities, believe it or not. But until the supply of drugs into this area disappears, you will have people who will feed their addiction by coming to the area. Brad Renfro, the actor who just died. Skid Row is, and again, I'm not qualified to talk about the homeless problem in Venice or Hollywood or any other place in Los Angeles or any other region of the country. Only on Skid Row do you have a crossroads of the world, not like Times Square, but of people who believed and unfortunately still believe that a culture of lawlessness allows them to come in there and live the lifestyle that they want to live.
Can I ask a simple question to the panel, and maybe to Ms. Osborne, and then we'll open it up. And I say this in a very non-ideological way. Why do we have to honor the past of Skid Row, number one? Why couldn't we just get rid of it, just for the sake of argument, and try to, on the one hand, rebuild that whole area, do something new with that whole area, and still have a very active way of seeking out people who have drug abuse that leads to mental illness and genuinely helping those people? Why would we keep Skid Row as a magnet for that?
Well, nobody wants to keep Skid Row. Let's just be clear about this. The containment policy is a disaster. It's been a mistake. If we had to do it over again, we wouldn't do it. However, there are 5,000 people who live in, help me here with the numbers, Jennifer, 5,000 people who are living in the SROs that are down there that are under the control of the nonprofits. I think there are...
Talk about 9,000 units of...
Is there a microphone?
...private ownership without covenant,
so one of the reasons that we have to honor the history is the reality that there's housing stock on Skid Row. We have an affordable housing crisis. This entire day, we have, I think it was one mention of what the root issue here is, which is that Los Angeles has a terrible affordable housing crisis. So one of the realities is, for better or for worse, is that there are a number of of hotels and housing that is run by Skid Row Housing Trust, SRO Housing Trust, that is in and around Skid Row. It's not that you don't want to transform it; it's that you don't want to just get rid of all the people who are there.
You can create a
mixed income community that honors the workers who live there and work in that area. It's an industrial area that honors the people who live in those housing units. And then at the same time, we can start to create mixed income housing, commercial, ground floor, the kinds of buildings that some of the more visionary developers like Tom Gilmore are talking about. And not have and not just sort of get rid of people. And that's where I think the mayor has the objection to the more dehumanizing conversation as it has come up and kind of stirred up by the Safer City Initiative, is there are people who really saw this as a way of getting rid of not just folk, not just the criminal, the super predators and the criminals. The back of the drug dealing has been broken pretty much on Skid Row in terms of becoming the center of the regional drug trade, is my understanding. It happened in the first 6 months of Safer City. But this isn't, public safety is not a good homelessness reduction strategy. Public safety is public safety, and we need to have a regional housing and services strategy.
Yeah, and all I was suggesting, that's good, good answer. All I was suggesting is I don't think we should even call it Skid Row anymore. Get rid of that attitude that it's Skid Row. And just say, this is Los Angeles, whatever community it is, we're going to treat these people with dignity. Because I think one way of not treating them with dignity is to continue to call it Skid Row and to act like it's acceptable for people to live and behave that way. They don't want to live and behave that way. That's been the message. I think you agree with that. I'm just talking about a new attitude. That's all I was suggesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
so, question over there, then we'll open it up. Sorry, you're next.
It's good to hear about all the collaboration that's going on. One question, where's the county? Where's the probation department? Where's the sheriff's department? Where's county housing? I mean, are we not part of a larger entity? Is the county of Los Angeles not have a $12 billion budget? Why is this being treated entirely as a city problem?
Well, I think because the containment policy was a city policy adopted by the Community Redevelopment Agency in 1975, because it's been concentrated in the city of Los Angeles, and over time, as you all know, the city of Los Angeles has a decreasing proportion of the population of the county. So very often the county, which by the way is a $21 billion entity, sees the city of Los Angeles as only one of 88 cities, even though we're $4 million people live there, 10 million. But let me just say about that, this is another one of the major barriers to creating a regional solution. For 30 years, Skid Row was the regional solution on homelessness. All pathways led to Skid Row, from the parole, from foster care, from the welfare system, you know, and that was the problem. Skid Row was the regional out of sight, out of mind solution. But one of the major barriers is you have the county, you have the city, you have LAUSD, and you have no history of, you have little history of collaboration. What's really happened in the last couple of years, and I mean, I give my boss a lot of credit, not just him individually, but catalyzing a partnership vision, so that this Project 50 that's taking the 50 vulnerable, most vulnerable off of Skid Row and putting them into permanent supportive housing is a county and city project. The LAPD's been part of it. The city and the county are working towards the brass ring, which would be a joint. No, because the county has the services and the city has the housing dollars, and the fix is housing with services. You need both, city and county dollars. But we have decades and decades of government entities that have no history of working together, and not to mention silos within them. So we're starting at square one we're starting beyond square one. We're starting with way behind the eight ball. We're the only city, the only major city that doesn't have a 10-year plan to end homelessness. Well, that's going to change because now we have new leadership at the Homeless Services Authority, which is the joint powers, and we have new collaboration among and between the city and the county. So things are beginning to change. I say it took 30 years to get here. It's going to take us at least 5 to get us out.
Question right here, this lady here.
Hi, good afternoon, morning. I'm Carrie Gatlin with the Union Rescue Mission, and this issue is so multifaceted, and there's about 100 things I'd like to talk about right now. And so in the grand scheme of things, this might seem like a really, really, really small issue. But I want to piggyback on something you said, Brian, because I think dignifying people is in the grand scheme of things, is a really critical piece to having people to accept and be ready to accept rehabilitation for themselves. As a service provider, we have worked long and hard to try to change the way we talk to people and about people, and even changing the language. I've heard people referred to today as the homeless and parolees and indigents and bums and so many different labels that we put on people. When you put a label on somebody like that, they begin to own that as their identity. And as a service provider, I can't change anybody. I can't make anybody get recovery. What I can do is build a relationship of trust with them so that I then have the ability to influence them and they trust, you know, somebody else's decision making for them. But I can't do that if I'm labeling people, because they begin to own that as their identity instead of their situation. And this is in homelessness and addiction and all of those things are situational. So I just wanted to make that statement.
Thank you. That's a good point. Thank you. Does anyone want to remark on that? No.
Question.
Heather had a question.
Ms. Osborne said that the root issue is a housing crisis, and that said that that was a new understanding of homelessness. I would say that that's been the received wisdom about homelessness since it became a public issue in the 80s. And while certainly making the market more available for a greater range of housing is important, I think that what we're seeing there on the streets is more, again, a behavior issue. As Estella suggested, a lot of these people would have homes, but their behavior has resulted in social disaffiliation. They have broken the ties with their families. They have no place to go back to because of the addiction and the mental illness. So I would say, we've seen the advocates try to change the subject for two decades now to an entitlement to housing, which should be debated, I think, separately from what we see on Skid Row. This is, again, about crime and people self-destructing. And again, the people that are working in the area have as much of an entitlement to safe streets as the people living on those streets, and you're not helping them by attacking the police.
Well, first of all, you're setting up a straw man, and you've done it several times. Nobody's attacking the police. The police are part of the solution. There isn't one, but nobody in this room is attacking the police, and that's who you're talking to, Heather. So, okay.
The police look pretty tough.
Let me just say, though, with all due respect, there is a body of wisdom and knowledge and know-how that comes out of the last 5 to 10 years that is not owned by some weird advocates on the margin. It is based on, it is data-driven, it is based on the best social science, it is based on the best medical research. There is a body of knowledge that shows that if you get the chronic street homeless, those who many people seem to think are service resistant, and they may be initially service resistant, that A, they are not service resistant for the most part, and B, if you get them into housing and stabilize them into housing, they will seek treatment for their addiction, and they will seek treatment, and they will stay on their meds. They will seek treatment and stay on their medication for mental illness. It's just wrong to blame the individuals themselves. It's bad philosophy, it's bad policy, and it makes for lousy solutions. And what George Bush has, while he's cut some housing with one hand, the Interagency Council on Homelessness has done the world a great favor by aggregating the know-how, spreading the word, and showing what works as a solution. Yes, it's individuals And I'm a recovering alcoholic with 17 years sobriety. Believe me, I understand about addiction. And at some point, people do have to take responsibility for their own lives. But they're going to be much more likely to take responsibility for their own lives if they have the stability of a home. Think of your own lives. Think of how destabilized it is when you're in between, or if you end up losing a job and living in your car or living with friends. Or think about what it does to your psyche, just that, let alone after 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years of doing the drugs. So this is, let's talk science here and not social theorists who have particular philosophies and ideologies. The science is in.
That's an oxymoron.
But the science is in. The science is in on this, guys.
I'd be very wary of that. It seems to me, my point is, let us not confuse the problem of Skid Row with the problem of homelessness.
Thank you.
Because the solution to Skid Row is not going to come about by providing houses or housing for a relatively small number of people. And while I don't completely mean this, nonetheless, for a lot of people, Skid Row has been a big sex and drug party for 30 years. And the victims of that have been people, included in the victims, have been the genuinely homeless who would benefit from the kind of services that you're advocating. But the problem of Skid Row has been a problem that is different than the problem of homelessness, although they overlap slightly.
Now, that's going to have to be the last word on this panel.
Because
now we can continue the conversation outside in the reception area, which will go from 12 to 12:30, but we all have to get out of this room with all of our stuff because they're going to reset that for lunch. But before you do, I'd like you to join me in thanking this panel. So again, everyone, bring all of your stuff with you out the room.
If I could have everybody's attention. I'd like to get our luncheon talk underway here. And our luncheon speaker, closing out what I hope has been an informative morning for all of us, really needs no introduction, certainly not to any of you, but I'll give you one anyway. William Bratton was appointed chief of the Los Angeles Police Department in October of 2002. This past October, he became, I believe, the first chief to be reappointed to a second five-year term in office in the city's history. Now, Chief Bratton oversees the third largest police department in the United States, managing 9,600 sworn officers, 3,000 civilian employees, and an annual budget that's, I believe, a little over $1 billion. His record as chief has been one of constant innovation, improving both crime fighting and accountability. After Chief Bratton's 4 years in office, crime in Los Angeles, including on Skid Row, has plummeted. In fact, to historically low levels, with serious crimes down citywide over 30% and homicides down 40%. And he's done this while expanding the LAPD's counterterrorism efforts in innovative ways that other departments across the country are learning from and emulating. Now, none of what has happened in LA would surprise any of us from New York, where he helped pull off the same remarkable feat in the mid-90s, while heading up the NYPD. He re-engineered New York's finest, boosting efficiency, police morale, and most importantly, reducing crime by the largest margins in the city's history. While at the NYPD, Chief Breton helped lead the development of CompStat, the acclaimed command accountability system that uses computer mapping technology and timely crime analysis to target emerging crime patterns and coordinate rapid and very effective police response. The concrete results of this public service include thousands upon thousands of people who might have lost their lives or livelihood if not for his efforts. A U.S. Army Vietnam veteran, Chief Bratton began his policing career in 1970 as a police officer with the Boston Police Department, rising to superintendent of police, which was the department's highest sworn rank. In the 1980s, Chief Bratton headed two other police agencies, the Massachusetts Bay Authority, I believe it's called, Bay Transportation Authority, and the Massachusetts Metropolitan District Commission Police, before coming to New York in the 90s. He's a frequent lecturer and commentator who I'm very proud to say has written for City Journal in the past. And among his many honors and awards, Chief Bratton holds the Schroeder Brothers Medal, the Boston Police Department's highest award for valor. And in 2007, he was honored by Governing Magazine as one of their public officials of the year. And to get a sense of just how successful he's been here in LA, you might check out a piece in the forthcoming issue of Playboy that was aforementioned. By a frequent LAPD critic, Joe Dominic. The piece is called Saving Los Angeles. Anyway, without further ado, we're very honored to have Chief William Bratton give our luncheon talk. Thank you.
I feel it necessary to clarify the Playboy aspect of this. Joe Dominic, who, as many of you from Los Angeles know, has been a long-term critic of the department and its practices, particularly in the 70s and 80s, wrote a book, a seminal book about the department, To Protect and to Serve. And indeed, it was one of the books I really delved into prior to coming into this position. Approached me a few months ago that he wanted to do a profile piece on me and reflecting on some of the changes he thought were occurring and were a direct result of my time as leader of the department. So I agreed to that, and then about a month later he came back, and the only taker was Playboy. And so we asked if we could go forward, and I said sure, that we've had presidents and everybody else, and you don't have to take your clothes off, so that worked out okay for me. In any event, there was a profile this month that I was very pleased with, and I have an edited version of it without all the other accoutrements that Playboy normally has. That I actually felt a little embarrassed on Sunday. I went up to my local newspaper stand to buy one, and the attendant that's known me for 5 years kind of looked at me, and I said, no, see, it's about me. So, as we know, you always pick up Playboy for the columns and the cartoons anyway. In any event, I've been asked to give about 15 minutes of remarks. Those of you who know me, I can do that without taking a breath, so I ask that you bear with me during those 15 minutes of remarks, which will be extemporaneous. I had hoped to have been here this morning to have my remarks come directly from all the discussions this morning, but I've been tied up in federal court yesterday and this morning testifying on a lawsuit against the department, and the mindless, mind-numbing word games you play in court over those 6 or 7 hours. I'm still kind of numb from the word games that we play in court. In any event, let me talk about this issue, but about it in a larger context. And that larger context is police in our society, the great democratic, constitutionally created society that we're privileged to live in this country. And I reference that because in that society, we the police are the principal entity, the most visible entity, and I would argue one of the most effective entities created by government for the purposes of controlling behavior that is in fact guaranteed by our Constitution, but we in exchange for the freedom that it promises agree through our laws, through our rules, regulations, ordinances, to modify our behavior to a common norm. And throughout my now 37 years in the police profession, I have come to increasingly embrace the single idea that I have sought to impart through all my career, that cops count, that police matter, that in our society, that without us, it would be anarchy, and we would not have any freedoms whatsoever. We cannot do it alone, and the discussion this morning, I think, reinforced what we can do, but a lot of what we are not able to do. Nevertheless, we are never at a point in time where we should not try, because the obligation is, in terms of when we are facing a problem, an issue such as the issues that we find in Skid Row, it is incumbent upon us, to the best of our ability, to try to do at least something. And so in the 37 years of my time in policing, I've watched a number of revolutions occur, and I've watched as my profession has matured from a time in the late 60s when we were anything but a profession, when there were very few people at the head of any organization in this country who had college educations, who had not risen through the ranks of policing, and who had literally had their experiences totally shaped by their internal experiences with very little exposure to outside thinking. Starting in the 70s, and George Kelling has written about this more eloquently than anybody I know in terms of the history of policing, we evolved in the sense of responding to societal changes and societal dictates from our legislative leaders and our communities. And the professional model of policing that developed was no more emulated than here in LA. LA became the poster boy of that model of policing, the idea of the move toward professionalism. And professionalism at that time really meant rapid response to calls for service, random patrol, and random patrol that had some degree of direction to it, and reactive investigations. Good old Joe Friday, my hero back in those days. We'd arrest him today for some of what he did back then, but back in the 60s and 70s, he was it. In any event, that model, it still remains an essential element of policing, but it failed miserably in that the 1980s saw, as a result of that inefficiency of police, the ineffectiveness of that model by itself, and the idea that police, particularly in this city, was saying, just give us enough resources, leave us alone, and we'll take care of it. Well, unfortunately, the way some organizations, and it was alleged and in some instances proven, that in taking care of it, we crossed the line. And in crossing that line, we continued to damage relationships. And in crossing the line, we opened up the way for some of the lawlessness that occurred and some of our ineffectiveness in dealing with it. But fortunately, moving into the 1990s and the evolution of policing, the next wave, the next revolution, if you will, community policing, I think with that we really found the model, the successful model, because it emphasized partnership. And in some of your discussions this morning, I think it is quite clear that while the police working with our partners in the criminal justice community, a city attorney, probation, parole, district attorney, other entities, certainly business interests, community interests, business improvement districts, that partnership could in fact bring about some resolution, not necessarily a solution, but some resolution and evolution towards solution of problems. And that by one, willingness to face the problems, that we might actually get to the third component of community policing, which is prevention. The idea that if police are used appropriately, we have three obligations to police constitutionally, to police compassionately, and by policing compassionately, recognizing that we are always dealing with human beings, no matter what their condition, no matter what their behavior, and that thirdly, to do it consistently. The idea being that so much of the failures of the 70s and 80s was that we would get in and we would get out. Whether it was a 911 call where we were being measured by how fast we get in and got ready for the next call, or by our response to neighborhood problems, we might get in there, make a few arrests, wash our hands of it and move along. We've learned from that. I've certainly learned from it in the many experiences I've had, and very specifically from exposure to George over many years and the many experiences that we've shared, in particular going into the New York City subway environment in which we were dealing with a very similar set of issues to what we are trying to deal with in the Skid Row area of this city. Similar issues. A homeless population made up of in the same, it's ironic, the same almost percentages, 85% who have either emotionally, alcohol, or drug impaired. And that population also attracted to it many others who were seeking to take advantage of that impaired state, a commission of crime and abuse, and that in the subways of New York, similar to what had occurred here in Skid Row, it was a problem that was not being addressed adequately, and the police were total failures in the way they were addressing it. But how it was addressed successfully there, and I believe is beginning to be and will continue to be addressed successfully here, is that embodiment of that community policing philosophy, that it requires partnership. Partnership to, in a semi, and I oftentimes use medical comparisons, that I liken what we're dealing with in policing to a doctor dealing with a cancer. It's various forms of cancer. There is the melanoma in the skin, which is an indication there might be something more serious underneath. And so basically what you want to try to do is get it while it's small, because before it becomes full blown. But so often when it becomes full blown, the treatment is oftentimes so severe that it is not without risk. Because effectively with chemotherapy and radiation, we're injecting poison into the body that, if not carefully modulated, can in fact ultimately kill or destroy healthy cells. Similarly, with us dealing with the cancer of the issues of crime, disorder, all the issues that we find in Skid Row or the subways in New York, or that we find in other neighborhoods that might not be generated so much by issues related to homeless population, but other elements, whether it's the gangs or the many other things that we focus our attention on, that the idea is that sometimes the condition has gotten so bad that it requires a medicine that we have to continually balance to ensure that we're not effectively poisoning the patient. And in my world, the policing world, that balance is to ensure that whatever our efforts are, that they are constitutional, that whatever our efforts are, they are compassionate to the best of our ability, and thirdly, that they are consistent, that we're not doing it differently. We may be doing it differently in terms of intensity in an area, because the problem is so intense, but that throughout the city, throughout law enforcement, hopefully, that is the driving element. So as we have begun to go at the problem, and I think for the first time successfully, and I do believe we are going at it from a law enforcement perspective successfully, we are in fact identifying other issues. And you discussed some of those this morning, and I think based on some of the conversations I've had here, and no surprise, that there is a recognition that there's only so much that the police can do. We can do a lot. We count. And so often, and I believe this is the case in cities in decay, areas of city in decay, that we are the most critical element, that we are the catalyst, we are the flashpoint. And I have really come to believe that even over history, we have been the flashpoint for so many negative incidents, whether it's the two sets of riots here in Los Angeles or elsewhere, we, if properly led, properly focused, properly partnered up, can in fact be just the opposite flashpoint, the flashpoint of the cutting edge in success. And I really do believe in our combined efforts to deal with the issues in Skid Row, that the actions of the police have been the significant flashpoint to eventually get us to what I hope will be a tipping point. I think we have arrived at a tipping point as it relates to levels of crime and disorder, in the sense that it is now seen as getting better, versus as recently as 2 years ago, it was seen as just getting worse and worse, if that was possible. However, we are at a point in time, as you would get with any tipping point, where the medicine needs to be modified. That in dealing with a cancer patient, you don't just keep pumping radiation and chemotherapy into that person, because you'll eventually either kill them or it will not have the desired effect. Similarly with our policing efforts, similar to the experience in New York City in the subways and then ultimately in the streets, I still think there is more room for tipping in terms of our efforts, and we are committed to keeping our police resources in that area. We are committed to working in increasingly creative partnerships with our law enforcement criminal justice system. But my perspective on Skid Row at this juncture is what is missing after all of our efforts over the past couple of years are the new forms of medicine that are going to allow us to effectively begin to use the police in other ways, in other capacities. And one of the things we have been able to accomplish is that this is what a doctor seeks to do. What is the extent of the problem? What is the extent of the medicine I need to apply to that issue? And so to that end, when we began about a year and a half, 2 years ago, we had a population on the streets based on our counts that was 1,750, 1,800. We hit population counts relative to the homeless of the tens of thousands. But as we know, they're not all in Skid Row. They're not all within that 50-block area. And the issue of concern in Skid Row is, in fact, for the police, those on the street who are either engaging in behavior that is not appropriate, authorized, or illegal, and those who may be engaging in behavior against them that is criminal, illegal, or inappropriate. We also have a multiplicity of clients in that area. Because the obligation is not just to serve the one and neglect the other. So the other clients we have, in many respects, as many of you in this room, whether it's the bids, whether it's the business owners, whether it's the various entities that are seeking to help the homeless, that we have to be, as police, in some respects, all things to all people, all at the same time. And it's a very difficult balancing act. I'm always reminded of the old last act in the Ed Sullivan shows where that juggler's out there trying to keep all those plates and going in the air at the same time and hoping that one doesn't fall and break. Because if one does fall and break, then basically the impression changes. So in our instance, we have attempted to be responsive to, in terms of intake, from all the various clients that we serve, to try to find that balance within those three areas of consistency, compassion, and constitutionality, that we don't effectively kill the patient or the patients, individuals, whether it's the business owners or those in the streets. But in our efforts, we've been able to reduce that population on the street. Question is, where have some of them gone? Some have clearly gone to jail, being quite frank with you, because a lot of those who were on those streets were the predators. They were down there to prey on the others. We've made a lot of arrests of them, and they're gone. Others might not have been down there as predators, but their continued use and abuse of drugs and other actions basically caused their revocation of parole, probation. So some of those have, in fact, been returned into the criminal justice system. Many others, based on the analysis by my personnel, were those that were kind of the hangers-on. But it was a place you could get drugs, you could go down and party, you could go down and not a life that most of us in this room would want to be engaged in, but there are many that would want to be in that environment where anything was allowed to go on. A lot of those people have, in fact, left because there have been controls put in place. We really don't know for certain, in terms of those thousand who were not there, where specifically they all went. So a lot of it's anecdotal, a lot of it's conjecture. But we do know they're gone, because month after month, we're down about that hardcore 750. The good news is the additional medicines that I talked about can now be applied. So for example, Project 50, to try to take those 50 who are the most significant service needers, go to the hospital the most often, arrested by us the most often, that just consume millions upon millions of dollars of services, that to try and get them into a new form of housing environment. Because many are resistant to some of the existing forms, whether it's SROs or the shelters that are down there, the missions, etc. The new environment, the new model, if you will, is intended to serve as an inducement to get many of these people off the street, modeled somewhat after some of the New York experiences and experiments, some of the stuff I'm familiar with. So we are at a point in time where, like a doctor, we have now, I think, identified what is the source of all those melanomas, that core problem in that 50-block area. Now the challenge is for the rest of society to step up and partner up with the police and some of the other entities that have been down there, the shelter providers, the bids, the other clients. And I think the one thing that is still missing, one person's perspective, in terms of those partnerships is, in fact, the real ability to deliver that housing issue. We talk about the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been allocated for it. We talk about all the grandiose plans and schemes. But with the exception of that Project 50, a lot of it's not come to fruition. The shelter for the homeless families out in the valley finally began to happen after incredible political hurdles had to be overcome. But Skid Row can, in fact, be a place where all the clients that we deal with can, in fact, inhabit it. But to get it to a point where everybody is comfortable with everybody else, the issue from my perspective is going to be the need to basically provide the various forms of housing and the job training and the various treatments. And unfortunately, at this particular point in time, that has not happened. And as I look at the budget issues that we've been getting briefed on in the city, and you're all aware of from the state and county level, there is a very dark cloud on the horizon, a gathering storm, if you will, that just as we basically got the crop planted and it's starting to flourish, all of a sudden we see this storm coming in that might have the potential, if we're not careful, to destroy so much of what we've done. My commitment to this community, and you're all part of this community, is that the police resources will stay, and as we grow, will be expanded to allow us to do things other than we've been doing.